I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University of Australia here in Fremantle today, Martin.
Absolutely. Looks like a nice day. I've grabbed my Freo coffee as well and ready to go.
Well, that's good. Let's hope that the Fremantle Dockers have a big win in Geelong, Victoria, tomorrow afternoon, Martin. And if they do, I'm predicting that the Fremantle City Council will start painting, even at this first game of the year stage, the streets of Fremantle purple, because a grand final win will then be inevitable.
Yeah, I note that you are wearing Geelong colours this morning, though, Michael.
I only did that to sort of provoke myself into my comment. Martin, we tend to do this. We find topics to talk about which take our minds off what's really going on in the world. And we will get to Trump and Iran. But first, can you tell me something about what's going on with the leadership of the National Party? I have to say, I'm convinced that they will very soon, under the new Senator Matt Canavan leadership, change their name to the Country Party.
Yes, well, this is an interesting development for those followers of national politics because David Littleproud resigned. And the interesting about his resignation was he just, I think it was only about 5 or 6 weeks, he fought off a challenge saying how enthused he was to lead the National Party. And now he's telling us he's, quote, buggered, Michael. So that's a big turnaround in 5 or 6 weeks. Anyway, he's walked off into the sunset. And not resigning though, which I think the Nationals will be pleased about, with another one by-election already to contest. And Matt Canavan's been elected a senator from Queensland. He, in terms of the national strategy, now some of our listeners may not like Matt Canavan, Michael, but in terms of his strategy for the Nats, it does make sense because he's a bombastic, quite conservative national senator, bring back Australian manufacturing, bring back everything made in Australia, Australia first. He's given the Nationals, they don't have to worry about teal candidates so much in city seats and whatever. They've got a few country independents to fend off, mind you. But their biggest challenge is One Nation. They're the ones in the gun. So I think it's been picked to really combat One Nation and to fend off the cannibalisation of their vote. And I think he'll be quite outspoken.
So why did David Littleproud walk the plank? I mean, he gave all the body language for quite some time of being a reluctant leader. He'd roll the sleeves up on his white shirt and he'd sort of stumble down the corridors. You'd think, does this guy really want to do this job? And it turns out he didn't. Well, at least that's what I've drawn from it all. He never really wanted to do it.
Yeah, the thing is, well, and I think he has come across as a bit of a reluctant leader and drawn along by forces that he's not that comfortable with at times. So Canavan had been nipping at his heels about, being a bit further to the right and combating One Nation for a while. Canavan's big on coal-fired power and all of those sorts of things, Michael. But he'd seemed like a reluctant leader, but I'm not sure what's actually changed in the last 5 to 6 weeks. Maybe there's something we don't see, but it is a marked turnaround for Littleproud.
I'm a bit surprised about it. Seems Canavan is very socially conservative. He doesn't like same-sex marriages. He's spoken and recorded on his late-term abortion approaches. But I mean, do all country people, do you think like Matt Canavan?
No, they don't. They've got fairly diverse range of issues on a number of things. A lot of country people are a bit unhappy, sometimes aggrieved at lack of services that they face compared to people in the city. So it's not uncommon for them to feel left out. And I think he'll be trying to speak to those kind of messages. As you say, country people are diverse like the rest of us. But I think a greater sense of identity about living and working in the country is paramount, in those places.
Matt Canavan, as an economist, once worked with the Productivity Commission, Martin. He also, when he left all of that and sort of went into politics, he became the chief of staff for Barnaby Joyce. So they'll know each other well, Barnaby having moved over to One Nation. Are we going to hear the same sort of One Nation language on topic of immigration from Matt Canavan?
I expect him to be quite anti-immigration, absolutely. And I think that'll be the one of the first things that he get really gets arcs up about. And he's already expressed sentiments along those lines anyway, Michael. But I expect that to be a bit of a centre plank. The complex thing though is in country areas, that's where there are often market shortages of labour. In that international visitors or international immigrants often service. Some of it's seasonal workers, like fruit pickers and the like, but there's a lot of gaps in skills in regional areas. So he'll have to be mindful of that as well. A lot of local businesses are not very happy with a simplistic anti-immigration stance.
Well, you sort of would be forgiven for thinking that some of the political stance of the One Nation and perhaps the Nationals, I find it hard not to call them the Country Party, is that if you come from one of those countries, like somewhere in the Middle East or certain parts of Asia, that you're going to be a quote unquote terrorist. We just can't let you into the country. But that means what?
I think there's that sentiment, and Middle Eastern immigrants in particular face that. Despite the fact that, of all people, some of the same people are very critical of Middle Eastern regimes. Now, the people fleeing Middle Eastern regimes, if you don't like the regime, you should be empathetic towards the refugees from that regime. So I think there's a bit of inconsistency in the rhetoric there.
Well, which actually brings me, because I haven't quite worked out how it happened or what's happened and what the present is, but we've had the women's football, soccer as we call it in Australia, happening, and then of course everything happened in Iran. The Iranian women's team was here. They seem to have had some protectors, like the old communist country used to do, send the protectors off with the ballet dancers and so on to make sure they all came home. But not all of the Iranian girls have gone back. What have you made of all of that?
I'm supportive of offering the Iranian soccer team girls asylum. Why wouldn't you? And they're facing a very difficult situation, and giving them the opportunity to choose whether they stay or go is the right thing to do. So I was pleased by those developments, albeit only some of them chose to stay, and that's their choice. But I do think there's a lot of hypocrisy around here because some of those same voices that were demanding that the government offer asylum to these girls were also really down on any form of immigration from the Middle East, particularly from Iran. And it's a reminder that we often have different standards for people that we feel a connection to. So the Iranian girls are on our television. They've perhaps been rebellious towards the regime in not singing the national anthem, and they've been attacked on state TV. So we feel empathy for them, but that's something we see. What about all the people from Gaza that were escaping horrific destruction there, and likewise faced a lot of persecution, not just from the Israelis but also from their own Palestinian leadership in Hamas. Where those people fit. So I think it's just worth reminding that there's a lot of people out here that are genuine refugees that have the need to flee and come to Australia. They should be subjected to due diligence, Michael. We expect that from a security perspective. But some empathy there is really important.
Well, I don't know where empathy fits in the US-Israel-Iran conflict at the moment. Martin, I've been trying to work out if they were so close to winning the war, or they'd done enough nearly, as President Trump said a number of days ago, why they haven't seen a sort of peaceful takeover by the citizens yet. And while all that's happening, we're told that the Straits of Hormuz are going to be fully closed off by the Iranians. I mean, if the Americans are hitting all of these Iranian sources. How come Iran is still fighting back?
The global ramifications of this conflict are now starting to really emerge. We're getting conversations all around the world about fuel shortages. Even here in Australia, I think literally this morning, the Australian government's announced certain measures to address fuel shortages. In Western Australia, state government's prioritising fuel for primary producers and other businesses that urgently need it to produce goods. So it's happening at an international, national, and local level, Michael. And I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Donald Trump about this because he's the real instigator. I'm not saying that the Iranian regime's not a very horrible regime, but of this immediate conflict and crisis, he's really precipitated that. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure on him to find an exit strategy. And I wouldn't be surprised if he does indeed find one within a matter of weeks.
Well, there's been a lot of interesting discussions. I mean, you can find a view on every angle in this debate, but there are a number of people who think and talk about the Iran conflict a lot, who seem to think that by the end of this month it'll be over. But over in what sense if it's over?
Yes, well, I don't think it'll be over properly. I can't see how this will be over properly in a couple of weeks. What we could see is Donald Trump bomb Iran to smithereens and basically deplete their military capacity further, assassinate some more leaders, declare that Iran is now weakened, severely weakened, and not a threat to anyone, and declare victory and walk off to the next thing. Of course, where Israel sits in all of that, Michael, who knows? I don't think they're inclined to stop at this stage. Does that mean Iran likewise accepts that there's peace? All of these, there's a lot of unanswered questions there that really emerge from this. And then, of course, that question would be what's really been achieved through the whole conflict. So these are really interesting questions we'll see emerge within a matter of weeks. I don't think this will go on indefinitely, Michael.
Well, we still don't really know what the objectives of the military intervention were, Martin.
Well, we hear something different each day, and we've canvassed this before, Michael. Is it the abolition of the nuclear arsenal that the old nuclear program of Iran? Is it complete demolition of their naval and military capacity? Is it the assassination of leaders, or is it indeed full regime change in Iran? Because all of those have been canvassed at one time or another. You could say that the first one is probably likely to have been achieved, and the second one somewhat as well. But what price has been paid for all of that? So that's the great uncertainty here.
Martin, it's often pointed out by people who've been following these sorts of conflagrations over many decades that when you do get regime change, it's usually because that country's military decides to intervene and get rid of the hated regime. That doesn't seem to be happening here. The Revolutionary Guards, if they remain in charge, are not going to help stabilise, you wouldn't think, the Middle East.
No, I think there is no united opposition. That united opposition doesn't have arms. There's not. I still think it's a high risk and unlikely that we're going to see a full-scale invasion from the US or Israel. So what's the agent for change? The Revolutionary Guard has a lot at stake here because they are the single most powerful institution in Iran at the moment. So why would they change that? I think right at this point in time, that might change if Trump either put troops on the ground or if he sponsored a third party, like in some distance. But that's a big change from what he's doing at the moment.
Well, what do you reckon the chances are of boots on the ground? That would turn it into Iraq, Afghanistan.
You couldn't put boots on the ground without committing to a longer term war. And that's the problem that Trump faces. No one denies America has overwhelming firepower. They could put troops on the ground and depose the regime, but that would, you're going to have basically anarchy and chaos that emerges then, and that's a longer term project. And I'm just not sure that he has the appetite to really go down that path.
Martin, I have the impression that if the fighting stopped today, that Israel would be reasonably happy that they've achieved a number of their medium and even longer term goals, quite independent of the United States. They will have they've already weakened Hamas in many ways, and we haven't heard about them much lately. They've been in to Lebanon and wiping out Hezbollah. And they've also been hitting Tehran in various ways. They've just claimed today that they've killed a senior scientist. So that all fits in to the way they appeal to Israelis, that they've reduced the likelihood of people coming in and attacking Israel. So they would be pretty pleased from that perspective, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they. You've got. We talked a lot about mostly about the US, but Israel's wanted to eliminate the leadership of Iran and to weaken them severely for decades, and so this is a long-term agenda for them. And I think they'd be very pleased with how things have gone, and they wouldn't be so keen to stop fighting, in my view. I think they'd be happy to go further. I think that they know they can't themselves change the regime just because they're a completely foreign power, and plenty of people would dislike the Israeli government in Iran, Michael. But they'd be very pleased with how much progress they've got.
Well, the new Iranian leader, Khamenei's son, hasn't been seen, Martin. There's some speculation that he mightn't, in fact, be alive.
Well, it's an interesting one. No one, I haven't, even the US and Israel have not suggested he's actually dead. But there has been suggestion that he's certainly injured, and everything from lightly injured to heavily injured, Michael, I keep on hearing. The fact that he's not appeared in public lends some weight to that. Of course, he would be very worried about being assassinated. There is a full funeral and period of mourning for the late Ayatollah that's coming up. That will be interesting because if he at all has capacity to do so, you would expect him to feature in that. So watch that space.
Martin, as of yesterday, the smart traveller advice from our Australian government attended to the topic of Israel, and they said the regional conflict is likely to continue and could escalate. Follow any warnings from local authorities to avoid areas deemed to be at high risk of targeting. If you wish to leave Israel, do not wait until it's too late. If you can secure a flight and it's safe to travel to the airport, leave now while commercial flights are available. Flight operations may be suspended due to airspace closures, and flight schedules may change at short notice. Due to heightened security concerns, the Australian Embassy in Tel Aviv is closed. Don't go to the embassy. And of course, it's an even heightened advice in relation to the Arab states, the UAE, Qatar, and the rest of them. Leaving aside the very short term, do you think the way those states, which have become quite friendly to the West, and Australians are used to going to Dubai and places and having holidays, will markedly change over the next decade?
It is a, I think the biggest blow, we talked a lot about Israel and Iran, and biggest blow is actually some of these Gulf states, as you mentioned, Michael, because the Gulf states have very carefully marketed themselves as great destinations and as major or really important players in global travel. Dubai and Doha airports are massive airports that huge amounts of planes fly through. And they have been increasingly important tourism destinations as well, and they're putting a lot of money into this because they know they need to diversify their economy. This has been a massive blow for them. Suddenly they're seen as unsafe, deemed as unsafe. There's going to be a lot of work for them over the next 12, 24, 3 or 5 years, Michael, who knows, to actually change that sense now. And I think there is some empathy from the Australian government that has very good relationships with these countries, which is why they've been chosen for our involvement in the conflict, which we haven't delved into a lot, Michael, but we are, whether people here like it or not, we are it's very much involved in this conflict now because we've actually sent military forces over there.
Well, we don't hear a lot from Putin, except he still offers himself as a general supporter of the Iran and related countries. We've heard very little from China. China has its own plans in the broader world, particularly in Africa and through Asia. Can we expect that they'll just sit there quietly watching?
Yeah, there's some interesting analysis out there about China and about China's not so much role in this, but how it might impact them. And I've read some interesting pieces about US strategy to China and how this might be linked. Think about Trump, though. I think that he's not a really strategic person. I think he's a deal person, and I think that the move by the US against Iran that perhaps helps them control more of the oil coming out of the Middle East might be helpful for them, but it also weakens some of their international standing in other places. We just talked about how people may not trust them when they're negotiating with them at the moment because Iran got bombed in the middle of negotiations. So how will that impact on other countries? China genuinely has a good relationship with Iran, so I think they'll be worried from that perspective. Russia, we know, has a good relationship with Iran, and neither of them are totally dependent on Iran, though. That's the difference. And Russia has massive oil reserves of their own, so energy and other energy reserves. So it's a complex picture. I would say that China would generally prefer peace and stability because they'll put a lot of work into economic links. And that's how they've been building their strength primarily.
I suppose something we can only raises an issue is the extent to which the world will stop being so fossil fuel reliant after all of this, Martin. It appears that the oil coming through the Hormuz Straits is what the world's depending on, even though President Trump has just pronounced the United States to be the biggest oil producing country in the world.
Well, there wasn't a strange comment though from Donald Trump. I get where he's trying to say what he's trying to say with this, but the way it came out was strange. Where he said, "When oil prices goes up, the US get richer." Right? I'm just wondering how many people in his own country like oil prices going up and other things that are related to oil prices going up. Because when you're already struggling with costs of living, bear in mind all the things that they import. A lot of things they import are subject to higher prices because of tariffs. Now, all those things they import are also subject to higher prices because they cost more to produce. That's if this continues, right? I just think that's a recipe for domestic disaster. And we've got midterms coming up for Trump later this year.
Martin, one of the difficulties from my point of view about the discussion we've been having this morning is that to an extent I feel as if I've been immunized, that I'm just accepting that all of this is happening and that there's no day where it's going to end and it's going to just drib and drab on. And the situation in the Middle East is going to be as bad as it's been for 30, 40 years, maybe worse.
Yeah. I'm a bit more optimistic than that just because I think it's not in the interests of the US to continue this for a lot longer. That's and nor is it in the direct interest of Donald Trump to do so. And one thing, Donald Trump's pretty unpredictable, but I don't think he acts against his own interests that much.
Well, Martin, we said last Friday that had mentioned to meet in a week's time and discover where things have got to. I don't think, on reflection, we were overly optimistic, but I must say I think I was thinking myself that we might have had some more notable steps in the resolution of this conflict, but I don't feel like, as I sit here talking to you today.
Yeah, like I said, I think that while we haven't seen much to date, some kind of deal to actually stop the fighting, not to resolve the issues, Michael, but to stop the fighting might be, it's certainly within the next few weeks. That's my view. We'll see if I'm right or wrong, Michael.
Well, you will be at some point, for whatever the reasons for stopping the fighting might be. Martin, as always, we mull over the, in a sense, the unmullable. But thanks for joining me today. It's a complicated time that we're in the world are facing, and I think people are sensing it everywhere.
Good to talk to you, Michael. Always a pleasure.